From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Some law enforcers want a path to citizenship for certain undocumented immigrants, and the governor responds.
This idea that unless you're an axe murderer, you should be able to stay, that is not consistent with our laws, and it's also not good policy.
Also this week, it's no secret many prices keep going up, especially when it comes to energy.
And we also obviously have what's going on with the war and the impact that that is having.
We'll also screen the new film documentary about the takeover of New College by conservative administrators. And we'll speak with a real astronaut about the big changes happening at the Kennedy Space Center and the future of American space flight. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Governor Ron DeSantis is weighing in after a council of law enforcement officers decided this week to draft a letter to congressional leaders. It's about creating a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who otherwise have no criminal record. Gina Jordan reports.
At a meeting of the State Immigration Enforcement Council, Chairman Grady Judd, who's the sheriff of Polk County, offered a real-life scenario.
There was one lady who was brought here from Colombia as a child. And now she's in her late 20s, trying to go through the process to become legalized. And she was scooped up out of a waiting room at ICE for deportation and back to Colombia. And it was like, well, where in Colombia do I go? I don't have any relatives. I don't know anybody in Colombia.
That's an example of why Judd and the council are working on a letter to send the country's leaders. They want the priority to be on criminals instead of law enforcement having to cast a wide net that's supposed to catch all undocumented immigrants.
If we stay on the mission that we're on, that I fully support 100%, and this letter talked about how do we create a path for those that need a path, it's not, if they waved a magic wand tomorrow and said, we're going to deal with that, we still have a lifetime of work of getting the illegal immigrants out of this country that are here illegally committing crime.
Another council member, Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, said he would support sending a letter to the feds. He backed Judd's comments about wanting immigration enforcement for criminals.
We are 100% full throttle in favor of it and support it. But what's right's right, and what's not's not. And going after this mom who's got three kids, who's just trying to make a living, who's been here for 15 years, and the whole scenario you described, that isn't right. And they do need to fix it.
This idea that unless you're an axe murderer, you should be able to stay, that is not consistent with our laws, and it's also not good policy.
Governor Ron DeSantis offered criticism a few days after the meeting, suggesting the council not send a letter.
You know, we have different people that are victimized by illegal aliens every day in this country. Not all of them have criminal records at the time. In fact, probably most of them don't. But under some view, it's like, okay, yeah, you come illegally, and then you stay until you commit a really violent crime. That just doesn't work. It's incoherent. It's not what the president ran on.
If somebody is here illegally in this country, then they have broken the law. Our job as law enforcement is to enforce the law.
Attorney General James Uthmeyer also quickly expressed disapproval over the letter. Judd, who's known for his tough stance on immigration, says his office remains focused on those accused of criminal complaints and sometimes the people with them.
We stopped the car for DUI, and he had two drunk buddies who were illegal as well, or a police encounter. We've not had any conflict out of the community because we're not going into strawberry fields or citrus groves or construction sites. It's not necessary to do that.
And Judd says he's not asking to give undocumented immigrants a free pass. He says they should pay a civil fine, learn English, and be required to work. A letter will be drafted and presented at the Council's next quarterly meeting. If members approve it, the plan is to send it to congressional leaders as well as President Donald Trump. I'm Gina Jordan.
The war in Iran is costing us at the gas pump. Prices have jumped due to disruptions in global oil supply, sending prices over $100 per barrel. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford spoke with FGCU Associate Professor of Economics, Dr. Victor Klar, for an explanation of how high gas prices could be just the beginning of surges in the high cost of living.
Americans have been facing a relentless onslaught of inflation since the beginning of the pandemic. Prices rose just from 2020 to 2025 alone by about 25%. Most Americans have not received a 25% increase in their pay, and if they did, that would just help them catch up. Now, I know inflation rates have been better lately, but inflation always punishes working class people the most because the things that hit them the hardest, food prices and oil prices and shelter prices, those are things that are a really big share of their budget. Those tend to be the things that increase the most. They definitely increased the most during the pandemic. And you feel like you haven't been able to get a break. I know inflation rates are lower now, about 2.6%, but it doesn't change the fact that prices continue to go up. Sometimes there is this lie we tell to ourselves that when inflation is not as big as it was last year, that we're doing better. But it's a little like if you've been gaining weight, maybe at 10 pounds a year, and then one year, an amazing thing happens. You only gain 8 pounds. You're still not moving in the right direction.
And we also obviously have what's going on with the war and the impact that that is having. And what is the expectation from your perspective for the next month or two? How do you see this shaping up as far as inflation and even the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, increasing?
Oil prices are especially tough because we don't have an abundant supply of oil ready to go at any given instant. Normally, it takes about 6 weeks for newly extracted oil to be refined into a consumer product, whether it's jet fuel or gasoline at your local gas station. That's a long lag, so it's hard to make more in a short amount of time. That's one of the reasons you see upward price pressure really quickly in a short amount of time. The other reason is that most of us, we have the same cars and the same commutes and the same distances to school and to work. And so when prices rise, it's not like we can afford to cut back very much. So when you've got an inflexible supply and demand by Americans that's also pretty inflexible because they need to get to the places they have to go, then you see really rapid increases in prices, and we've seen that with oil.
How long do you project or see? We don't have a crystal ball, but how long do you foresee this price hike in gas continuing?
A lot of analysts envision two possible scenarios. One is that in the course of the next couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, the White House changes its posture on Iran and decides not to be as committed to its involvement as it has been during the run-up to the end of March. If we see that, we'll see higher prices, maybe oil prices that are still above $100 a barrel, but not much higher than that. We may see consumer prices year to year that are somewhere around 2.5% to 3%. The other scenario that a lot of economists see right now is that we stay in Iran for the longer term, maybe late into 2026 or even into early 2027. If that's the case, then we could see much more significant increases in the price of a barrel of oil, not $100, but maybe $140 or $150, and persistent consumer inflation that is not 2.5% or 2%, maybe 4% or even higher still.
The CPI, the Consumer Price Index, impacts a lot of people when that would be increasing. Explain what that is.
The Consumer Price Index is a monthly survey of the prices that real Americans pay for the things that they purchase most frequently. It's not everything that consumers buy, but it's the things that they typically buy in a given month. And so the federal government thinks that's a nice way to measure consistently from one month to the next what the real cost is of things like gas, food, shelter, all of those things, they're included, and they're the most basic things that a typical family buys in a month. But the weights in that basket for the CPI, they're very representative of what actual consumer buying patterns are.
So if that increases and continues to increase, we've got to tighten all of our belts.
For most of us, our biggest bill is shelter. whether it's our rent or our mortgage payment, that's our biggest bill. After that, things like food and gas are second and third. So if the price of gasoline goes up a lot, so does the CPI. And you see that really, really quickly, because not only is it a significant price increase right now, it's something that is a big share of every American's budget, because those are the basics. Those are the things that punish all Americans, particularly working class Americans. You have to figure out how to fit in other things around those three big things. Only then should you think about what you might be able to do with other money that's left over. So be laser focused on the things that keep your family alive and in good shape from one month to the next.
Hopefully this will be for the short term and not the long haul.
Yeah, but at this point, nobody really knows. There's a lot of uncertainty. We've already had a lot of uncertainty in the last 9 months or so because of tariffs. And it's really hard for businesses to make plans into the future. And it's hard for American families to make plans if it seems like every day we don't know which goods will be tariffed, how much the tariffs will be against different countries. And now we have even more uncertainty with a war that a lot of people did not see coming with an uncertain end date.
That was Dr. Victor Klar speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Coming up on Capitol Report, the re-engineering of Florida's new college prompts a new film documentary. We'll hear from the producer.
It's very hard to relive a lot of what they went through, but it's just so meaningful.
And the growth of private sector space launches at Florida's Kennedy Space Center has meant only good things for the program, says the astronaut in residence there.
Brought a whole new level of attention to the Space Center and to the Visitor Complex, and it's exciting times.
A film tracking the conservative takeover of New College of Florida, titled First They Came for Our College, just finished a run at the South by Southwest Festival in Texas. WMNF's Chris Young speaks with the film's producer, New College alumnus Harry William Hanbury, but he first asked director Patrick Bresnan why the story of the Sarasota school is relevant.
I knew immediately that there was a very important film to make here because emotions were so high when I arrived on the campus. I had never seen anything like it. These were not students protesting wars in foreign country. These were students protesting the firing of the president of their college, who would go and sit in the cafeteria with them on a weekly basis, whose door was always open. Their professors who had passed all of the requirements to receive tenure were being denied tenure. Their librarian was fired. And this very peaceful, highly rigorous academic college had just been turned into a battleground. And this story had to be told. It had to be documented.
Harry, as a New College alumni, how did it feel to go back on campus seeing everything that's happening?
For a long time, it reminded me of this great film about the French Resistance, Army of Shadows by Jean-Pierre Melville in 1969, where all the people who were resisting the Nazis were kind of creeping around doing these secret handoffs. There were new surveillance cameras installed all over campus. So I felt very much like an interloper, like I was not welcome in my own home, which was awkward, painful, scary. We finally did reach out to the administration and did a lot of filming on campus with their full approval.
Were there any times the camera captured anything that surprised even you guys?
I think the gutting of the Gender and Diversity Center was a real gut punch to me when I first stepped foot on campus. After 30 years, I was extremely emotional when I saw the Gender and Diversity Center, because there was nothing like me, nothing like that for me when I was a queer kid, just coming to New College. There was a very supportive environment, but students had built that over 30 years. And to see that that was just completely emptied, all of the care that students put into accumulating hundreds and hundreds of books, they were just thrown in the trash at the end of the summer when no students were around. So I did not film that scene, but watching it was extremely emotional.
In the film recently screened at South by Southwest, congratulations. Patrick, could you tell me a little bit about that?
South by is a really big festival. It's an incredible audience. Our screenings were sold out. People were in tears. Our students, really, when we do Q&As after a film, we had three students with us and Amy Reed. And so we just kind of turned the mic over to them and allow them to interact with the audience. So it's a profound experience for people who've gone through this. It's very hard to relive a lot of what they went through, but it's just so meaningful to see the outpouring of support that audiences have had for people who've been through this.
That was producer and New College alumnus Harry William Hanbury and director Patrick Bresnan speaking with WMNF's Chris Young about their documentary on New College of Florida. In an email, New College president Richard Corcoran called the film sensationalized and disconnected from the reality of what's happening on campus. A humanitarian convoy carrying over 20 tons of food, medicine, solar panels, and other goods for Cuba will converge in Havana tomorrow. The island's unprecedented economic and humanitarian crisis has only gotten worse after the Trump administration placed a blockade on any fuel sent to the island. David Adler is with the group Progressive International, and he is one of the organizers of the convoy. He spoke with Danny Rivero.
It was originally proposed as a flotilla of boats bringing aid to Cuba amid the deteriorating humanitarian situation on the island, but it's morphed into something else. Can you tell me why you and other organizations are involved in this convoy?
So let's start with the original idea of setting sail for Cuba in a flotilla carrying critical humanitarian aid for its people. The motivations for that flotilla are twofold. The first is in recognition of the stark conditions and the humanitarian crisis, not just aggravated, but inflicted by the United States on purpose against the Cuban people, in particular since the 29th of January, when Donald Trump announced an executive order declaring Cuba an unusual and extraordinary threat to the United States and establishing a fuel blockade. There's no country in the world that could survive a fuel blockade. None. It's just impossible to imagine.
Yeah, we're seeing with the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, an international freakout because of a 20% reduction. The consequences could be absolutely catastrophic for many economies.
They already are. And we're seeing, you know, looking at Bangladesh and looking at India, they're talking about rationing oil, and that's causing a panic and meltdown in the markets. We're in the Cuban case, we're talking about 100%, not reduction, stripping out petroleum entirely from the economy.
You're one of the organizers of the global Sumud flotilla to Gaza that was intercepted by Israeli forces in the Mediterranean. You ended up in an Israeli prison as part of that. Anything that you learned from that experience in the Mediterranean that you're bringing towards this in the Caribbean?
So one of the scary things is seeing how, having been normalized in the case of Israel, restricting access to food, restricting access to electricity, restricting access to critical resources to the people of Gaza, having been normalized in that part of the world, the United States is now importing that tactic into the Western Hemisphere. And so we think it's very important to resist that normalization, to stand up against this tactic of siege, which is such a menace to the fundamentals of international law. And the second thing we can learn is, you know, as much as these direct action initiatives are painted as provocation, they're totally legal. Humanitarian missions are so extensively protected under international law. So it's this general defense of international law through these really urgent and necessary forms of direct action to provide the resources from which the Cuban people have been starved.
So you have people planning to arrive in Havana by air, by sea, and converging in Havana on Saturday, the 21st of March. Do you have a rundown of some sort of what you expect to actually happen in Havana on that day?
Yes, different delegations have different itineraries that they design. Some of them are more focused on journalistic activities and trying to sort of talk to people and figure out firsthand what's really happening on the island. So the 21st is this great convergence. We'll have a big ceremony where the aid is handed over to Cuban civil society, and the different delegations are able to meet and speak to each other and think together about what it means to stand up in support of the Cuban people. That will be part of that program. In the case of a lot of the cold chain medicine, that has to be given directly over to hospitals. So there are special permits that you get when you do this kind of shipment of medicines so they can reach the hospitals. But the more people-to-people diplomacy, the people-to-people to aid, that's being conducted always through, civil society. And there's lots of organizations, Puentes de Amor, even the Havana Synagogue, lots of organizations that have been conducting these kinds of aid missions for a long time.
That was David Adler of Progressive International speaking with Danny Rivero. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after several decades of essentially being in the doldrums, going to space is cool again. And it's not just because of all the seemingly endless variations of Star Trek reboots. It seemed timely, therefore, to chat a bit with a real astronaut. Retired Navy Captain Winston Scott flew on two space shuttle missions. Today, he's the astronaut in residence at the Kennedy Space Complex Visitor Center.
Zero and liftoff for the final launch of Endeavour. Expanding our knowledge, expanding our lives.
The preeminence of so much of the private sector with SpaceX. And last time I was down, I saw a Falcon 9 go up, and it's not like the old days. But what does that mean to you down at the Kennedy Space Center and how that has kind of changed the entire environment down there, certainly operationally, but also for folks who want to come to the visitor center?
Absolutely. It has changed, and the change has been for the good. People may think that SpaceX and Blue Origin and all of those just showed up one day and started launching rockets the next day. Didn't happen like that. What's going on now, I and my team pushed for over 20 years ago. I directed the Florida Space Authority under Governor Jeb Bush between 2003 and 2006. And we were pushing then for what you see happening now, for NASA to open up its facilities to the commercial companies, for the 45th Space Wing to open their Eastern Range to the commercial companies. And now it has come to fruition. And it's good because the commercial companies have done exactly what we wanted them to do, and that's make access to space more affordable, more cost-effective, and so on. So I love it. We have so much going on down there. We launched over 100 rockets last year and on track to beat that record again this year. So it really is exciting what's going on down there, and it's brought a whole new level of attention to the Space Center and to the visitor complex, and it's exciting times. We love it.
Well, that also means that there is a lot more, I guess, public recognition of the fact that we are back in the game, at least as far as vehicular missions are concerned. How do you see everything playing out first with a return to a lunar touchdown at some point and perhaps even Mars? Do you think that is going to be tracking the way that the advocates say, or do you think we're possibly going to run into some unexpected difficulties that may at least throw that trajectory a little bit off track?
Well, I sure hope it continues because we're making good progress now. You probably know this, but the Space Launch System for Artemis II, and for people who will listen to this, Artemis II is the lunar mission scheduled to launch here pretty soon to take astronauts back to the moon. They will not descend to the surface, but they'll fly to the moon and then back home for a complete end-to-end test of the Space Launch System, the Orion capsule, and then with a launch target date of April 1st. So I think the Artemis launches will go, and we'll put people on the moon, put boots on the moon here another 3 or 4 years from now with Artemis 4. And then hopefully we continue that trajectory and then send astronauts off to Mars. These things are certainly subject to the whims of the administration in office at that time. So hopefully whatever administration is in office will keep the program on track so that we can continue our exploration of space the way we should.
Something else that we need to explore, though, is certainly the preparation for a new generation of space explorers here in this country, and with now a newfound emphasis on STEM programs and all of that. Do you think we are adequately preparing our young folks to continue in the footsteps of you and even back to Colonel Glenn and all the great pioneers in space?
I do. I think our universities and our other training and education facilities are doing a good job preparing young people. And space is still very exciting to young people. I talk to thousands of them every year, and young people are very excited about it. I think we're preparing them. What the obstacles, if I may use that term, comes from the lawmakers, you know, how much emphasis they put on our space program. And right now we see a great emphasis on it, and hopefully that will continue. But in terms of preparation, oh my goodness, we've got some young, bright, creative people, youngsters coming along these days. I tell you, every generation learns so much more, so much earlier than the previous generation. So I think we're going to be in good hands in that respect.
And probably it would be helpful if you'd reiterate something that I heard so many decades ago when the space program was just really taking off, literally and figuratively, and that is that so much of the research that goes into perfecting the launch vehicles and the environmental systems and propulsion and everything else that's connected with the program has a very real-world impact when it comes to products that impact our lives every single day right here on Earth. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Absolutely. People take it for granted, but everybody on Earth uses some kind of space technology every day. And one example is what you and I are doing right now. This interview, I'm in my hotel room talking on my cell phone, and you are wherever you are probably talking over your cell phone, another piece of equipment that had its maturity, if not its genesis, in the space program. People pull out their cell phones and they navigate. Well, that navigation is GPS, a global positioning system, satellites. Who do they think put the satellites up there? You know, a lot of the foods they buy, you know, we see weather from space, we are agriculture. Every aspect of our lives every day has some benefit in it that came from America's space program. So it is important that people realize that, I think, so they will understand the importance of continuing to explore space.
Captain Winston Scott, two shuttle missions, a total of more than 24 hours in space, and one of our most prolific extravehicular spacewalkers in the entire program history. It is so great to have you on, and onward and upward, sir, and we hope to see you around the Kennedy Space Center.
Well, I sure hope so, but before I finish, let me invite everybody here in Tallahassee to come on down and visit us at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. The motto is Discover Something Real. So you'll feel as though you're actually leaving the Earth and exploring space in some of the exhibits and rides that we have there. So come on down and visit with us.
Thank you so much, Captain, and you take care, sir.
Thanks a lot. Take care now.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford, Chris Young, and Danny Rivero. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Tim McGuire, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.